Hey everyone, it's Jordan here. Before we dive into today's episode, I'd like to take a moment to introduce our sponsor, Jane. Jane is an all-in-one practice management software with features like online booking, scheduling, documentation, and a PCI-compliant payment solution. The time you spend with your clients is valuable, and filling out forms during their appointment can quickly drain your time together. That's why the team at Jane has designed online intake forms that your clients can complete from the comfort of their homes. And to help them remember to fill out their forms, Jane has a friendly reminder email sent 24 hours before their appointment. This means they arrive ready to go to start their appointment. Jane's online intake forms are fully customizable to ensure you're collecting everything you need ahead of time, whether that's a credit card on file, insurance billing details, or signed consent. You can build your intake forms from scratch or use a template from Jane's template library and customize it further to meet your practice needs. If you're interested in learning more, head to jane.app/guide or use the code EDGECOUCH1MO, EDGECOUCH, numerical 1MO at signup to receive a 1 month grace period on your new Jane account. Allison and I love Jane. We've used it for years and we think you will too. All right, on to the episode. Welcome to Season 6 of Edge of the Couch. We are here to create a space to delve into the topics that were either shied away from or dismissed because they were too big, too nuanced, too risky, or too uncomfortable to talk about in school or even supervision.
Edge of the Couch is not training or supervision. It is for student therapists, new therapists, and therapists wanting to continue to explore their evolving therapist identities and ways of working. When we are talking about clients, please know we are deeply committed to protecting client confidentiality. We are two passionate therapists and good friends sharing our personal opinions about the therapeutic process.
Come join us at the edge of the couch. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Edge of the Couch. I'm Jordan Pickell.
And I'm Allison McCleary.
And today we're talking about shame, working with shame, clients' shame as it comes up, but also when you can see it happening for the client, but they're not necessarily naming it. What's the first thing that you think of when you think of shame?
Shame comes up a lot in the literature and in pop psych, but I never remember learning specifically about shame in our program. I don't know if I learned about like any specific feelings really, but I think that having now been a decade in, that I see shame a lot in the work that my clients are doing. I didn't even really understand what it was as a new therapist, and I didn't know what to do with it when it became evident in the therapy room.
I just thought of a way that we could frame this conversation. And you tell me if this is something that resonates with you. We could define shame and then maybe talk about how maybe different orientations see shame, because I do think the way that one frame sees shame and how to work with it is going to be different than another. Even for myself, I can imagine I do employ these different ways of thinking about shame. And so that might be a good starting off point before getting into like the nitty gritty of how we might respond in terms of micro skills.
Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, so do you want me to quickly share my Brené Brown?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
Frames it. And I know not everybody is a Brené Brown fan. And I did learn a lot about shame through her writing. How her research has defined shame is that shame is the feeling like I am bad. So there's something broken or wrong with me as a person. And that's why this has happened, or that's why I keep making these mistakes, or whatever the narrative is, which differs from things like embarrassment or guilt even, because those more are feelings like, oh, I've done something bad, or I did something that made me, you know, very visible to other people. So the difference between guilt and shame is I am bad versus I've done something bad that I need to apologize for example. So that's how I work, how my understanding and framework for shame when it shows up is like an internal sense of like badness, wrongness, brokenness, that type of genre.
Mm-hmm. The first thing that I think of is sort of an AEDP perspective of shame, which is that it's one of the blocking emotions. So you know how some people talk about like anger being a secondary emotion? Mm-hmm. This is sort of how in AEDP, anger is a primary emotion, and then shame, guilt, and anxiety are seen as secondary or like blocking emotions. So the idea is, as we sit with shame,
and work with it together in session, the emotions underneath can arise. So things like grieving something that we should have gotten, or anger at something at someone else for doing something to us that now we've internalized as shame,
right,
because the anger is untouchable. So instead we go to shame. That's the framework that I'm thinking of it in.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think very similarly in existential psychotherapy, we look more to what some of the literature in existential psychotherapy calls like the spacesuit. So it's like, what is getting in the way of like feeling what is there? And so it's like, what separates us from the world, the spacesuit. And so shame, I think, is like, I love that we're calling it a blocker. I think shame really like builds defenses because, you know, the way that I think about shame is that it's a very, very tender feeling. It creates a lot of reactivity. And so in psychodynamic, we would call them defense mechanisms because it is that internalized message. It's not the world, it's me. We would work backward from like, what is here that makes it difficult to get to the shame? We would kind of work through that to then be able to access the feeling of shame.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the relational cultural, just to add another theory into here, a relational cultural framework for actually addressing shame, which is that the more that you are able to sit with it, for it to be witnessed, the more that you can sort of incorporate it back into your wholeness, the more that you feel open to showing other people, you just feel more energized and more connected and more confident and all those pieces.
And I would assume if we were thinking about this through a CBT framework, it would be shame as a result of specific thoughts. I am bad. I am broken. That then, you know, we think about the cognitive triangle, right? We begin to feel that heavy, sinking black hole feeling that shame is when we are stuck in the thoughts of there's something wrong with me. I can never get it right. I mean, the list of specific thoughts is endless, but that and then we would look at the emotion or like the body sensation, which is like that sinking feeling or whatever. And then we would look at what it makes us do with our behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think for IFS, it would be like exile parts.
Yes.
That we would be looking at through an IFS lens. And as we're talking about this, I'm also realizing, yes, these frameworks can sound quite different, but when you get down into the actual work in the relationship, in the room of therapy, it can look very similar.
Oh, totally.
Does it feel like we can move on, or is there something else you wanted to add?
That's great. I love thinking about the orientation piece. And if you're listening, please share with us how what orientation you work from and how maybe they conceptualize shame or how you would, because we always want to be learning and expanding our understanding of things.
Then how do you work with shame in session?
It's a great question, Jordan. I think this is, if I'm a new therapist, this is what I want to know. It's like, what do I do once I see it there? Like, great, I see the spacesuit. I see that there's maybe anger underneath. What next? And I think when I think about working with shame, it happens in both explicit and implicit ways. So I will explicitly talk to clients about what shame is, and I'll share, hey, shame is one of the feelings. This is how it can kind of show up. This is often what's coming along with it. That thought of like, I'm broken, I'm bad in some way. And I will kind of name that for people, or once I have clients who've expanded their emotional vocabulary or that granularity, that I will say, hey, I wonder if this is shame coming up, or, you know, is this anger? Is this shame? Like, I might ask a client that, and that's the explicit way. But then there is this much more implicit, much more relational process of undoing shame, if that's how we want to frame it, that is much more about making it clear to the client that you're going to consistently show up for them. You're going to have similar messages for them. What they share with you is not going to reduce your care for them. And that when they go into the place of, I'm a bad person, that I'm neither going to dismiss that or agree with it. That I am consistently going to show up as like, I just don't believe that. And here is why. And I want you to see it. So that's much more the implicit way.
Mm-hmm.
What about you?
Well, I think the relationship, like you said, is always the first thing. Setting a foundation so that someone can speak to it rather than just experience it, so that we can observe the shame. Because otherwise, they're just going to be so in it that we can't look at it. And that's another piece too, is often in therapy, shame is so entrenched, especially if you're talking about like it rooted in childhood, violence, neglect, abuse, but for anyone really, it's mm-hmm. a deep, deep, deep
yes.
feeling that is sometimes like a totality of who you are, something that people are carrying around with them that they don't realize, you know, that that could even change versus mm-hmm. somebody who's like what you're talking about, like I did something bad. I think it makes me irredeemable kind of shame. And I want to confess it to you and I want you to accept me and then to sit with that. That's a very different experience, I think, when a client is coming to say, I did this thing and I think I actually think it makes me a bad person.
Yes.
Then we sort of talk around it. How would it feel to share that with me? And then creating a relationship where it can say it and sit in it. Like, what does it feel like to have shared that with me and to feel what's coming up now? And sometimes it's relief and sometimes it's like terror Ooh. Of being so, so, so vulnerable. And I think that that's like a very somewhat simple way of moving through shame. But it's when it's the long-term work that I think is way more challenging and difficult to nail down, to even name it. Like, this is something that you mm-hmm. feel. And it's kind of like, yeah.
And it's right. I'm right.
The whole I'm worthless thing, like when people feel worthless, that's tied with shame in terms of like, it's all encompassing of who I am. Yes. And it's something that's been true for me as long as I can remember. Mm. And that's really hard to even imagine undoing.
And I think there have been moments where I am really rocked and shocked by the level of that infused shame my clients are experiencing, that clients can seem like they have a lot of emotional knowledge and they've done a lot of personal work. And then as you dig, you realize that there is a lot of shame underneath the surface. And there's sometimes I have these moments of like, I've been really like startled by the level of self, almost like hatred, whatever that is. This like disgust with self or this shame, this worthlessness. It sometimes really shocks me. Oh, okay. We are not in a place of just like learning to name your emotion. You do not like yourself on like a cellular level, and the work is going to be long and slow. And I don't mind that the work is long and slow.
That's familiar to me. To me, right. This is my own personal work of undoing shame. Like I know what that feels like. And so when I recognize it in another person, and I feel like I've done a lot of work and can, like, I see that there's progress. I see that that's possible.
Right.
And I see how long-term the work is. Being able to hold that, this doesn't have to be this way. It can get better.
Mm-hmm.
I think is another thing that is a gift to clients. You feel this way. It feels all-encompassing. Even being able to name it to people like, oh, I'm seeing this in you. And it's at a cellular level. Mm-hmm. And it's not true. And this can get better.
Yes.
Obviously, like you said, the words, they don't fully land, but even just to say it out loud, I see this and it doesn't have to be this way. You know, I've seen with clients that were unwinding shame for them over the course of years and like them looking back and being like, wow.
They also don't recognize the depth of it.
Yes.
You know,
until they're sort of coming out of it. Sometimes part of that is like being able to name childhood experiences mm-hmm. and to say, oh, mm-hmm. this is what was going on. And now I'm realizing that it wasn't me. Yes. It wasn't me as a bad person.
Yeah. Bad kid.
Like, why does this feel so terrible? And why am I reacting this way to the world? This is happening. It must be my fault. That I think a lot of kids internalize, being an adult and being able to see, wait, that wasn't okay. It shouldn't have been like that. And I didn't deserve that. That's some of the longer term work about undoing shame that they've internalized that should not be theirs.
I have had these experiences with clients where I'm taking them back to a younger version of themselves and they're still in the place of thinking that younger version deserves what they're getting. Okay, how do we help you to see that like no 4-year-old deserves that? Or, mm-hmm. you know, where there's that sense of like, I should have known better. Well, you were a toddler. Toddlers don't know these things. And I also think about how many of my clients have actually been told by other people for a long time that they are bad, they are broken, there is something wrong with them, which is mm-hmm. like classic abuser tactic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so there is also the client's experience of it. And then if anyone in their life has, you know, like validated that really horrible thought, which again, abusers often do, mm-hmm. it's like gets cemented.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes they come to therapy going like, how do I fix myself? Yeah. And then you start unpacking things and you're like, wait, you're responding to things that are happening around you or explicitly said to you. And like the goal of therapy is so different. Like the work of therapy is so different than what they came to do. It's like, oh, wait, that's like you're being gaslit. Like, actually, it's not you.
And that's so interesting when a client, and I'm sure you've had this experience, Jordan, I know I have, where when a client comes to therapy, I think we did an episode about when clients have like unrealistic goals, but when clients come to therapy and their goal is like, I want to become a good person. I want to stop being so bad. Okay. As a therapist, I'm thinking, I think that we can see that's a shame-driven goal often for clients.
I want to fix myself.
I want to fix myself, especially when it's like, I want to fix myself so this other person stops having these reactions to me. Like, I want to be so much better so my partner won't have anything to be annoyed with me about anymore.
So that I don't trigger him because I keep triggering him.
Yeah, because I keep saying the wrong thing and then we get into fights, you know, and it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I have like alarm bells in my head that are like, this is interesting and not probably going to be the work that you're expecting to do if you're coming in as a client in that way, because it's just, I'm not going to get on board for that goal. So it is really interesting.
Sometimes the work around shame is implicit, where it is, like you said, that showing up and being and asking questions. Sometimes it's like, I disagree.
Totally.
I don't think you're broken. Yeah. Like, I want to fix myself. And I'll be like, I don't think you're broken.
Yeah.
I think that how you're responding makes a lot of sense.
Totally.
And I just cut right through it and say that, which we weren't really trained to do. But and I do think you have to be careful because sometimes you can jump way too far ahead. But
too soon. Yeah, you can do it too soon for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just give the client whiplash. But sometimes they are like going in this, how do I change myself? I keep doing this thing. And, you know, and then I go like, it makes a lot of sense to me why you're doing that. Sometimes I actually do skip over the feeling. It's like the opposite. Sometimes it's like sit with the feeling and be with it and wait until it opens up like a flower. And sometimes it's, okay, you feel really bad. Well, let's actually talk about what's real here.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's not true. Like, I'm not going to entertain that anymore.
Totally. And I think that is usually further along in the process. Like, this is not session one, usually.
Right. Yeah.
You've maybe laid the groundwork for the foundation with the client first. And if you're listening and you're thinking, but I don't know the difference, I do think that you begin to feel an intuitive sense of when the work with your client is about sitting in that unfurling and that kind of seeing and the slowness. And once you've done that a lot of times, sometimes you just can't do it again because you can see that what is happening for the client is that they're getting kind of stuck in that narrative about the feeling, which is like, I feel bad because I must be bad. Versus like, this is a hard feeling. So that I do the same thing. I also sometimes will just say, like, I certainly said, like, I just don't agree with you. Like, I don't agree with that. You're saying it, that's yours. You can hold it, but I don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll ask, like, even if that were true at some point, which I don't think it ever was, have you grown beyond that? You know, because sometimes clients are hooked on mistakes, and I'm saying that in air quotes, from decades ago, years ago. Can we encourage clients to kind of evolve past it? It's like, okay, that's there, but can we change? Actually, the way that I use the talk about it is, do those cowboy boots fit you anymore? Because sometimes I say to clients, these are great cowboy boots. Wow, they looked great at one point. They don't fit anymore. And I can see you really trying to shove your foot in there. And can we just like let go of that pair? We don't want to be flippant when it comes to shame necessarily, but sometimes I think we have to like talk about what comes next.
Yeah. And when you talk about that, well, that was years ago. I think that sometimes they're like, if we can shift it into guilt and what needs to be done.
Yes.
Is there apology? Is there an apology you should make? Is there some amends you can make to make this right? Some people really do think I need to punish myself by feeling this way.
Yes, I know.
It's and like so to not feel this way means that I don't think it was a bad thing or something.
Exactly. I have two thoughts coming up. And I'll share them. The first is that some of clients really want like a redemption arc, and that's not always possible, where they want to like apologize to that person and have that person forgive them, or like clients feel like desperately in their bones that they wish they could go back and do it differently. And that is a swirly place where clients can be. I've had many clients who spend their time in therapy just saying, but I just wish I could undo it. And that's hard. It's hard to live in that space. But then there's also this other thing that I think we're naming, which is that for a lot of feelings, they are temporary, right? We know what happens with a feeling. They like kind of build like a wave and then they break and then they dissipate. So sadness, anger, jealousy, if we ride them out, they will often lessen, even if it's like 5%, but they're not going to stay that intense forever. But shame is different, I think. Shame is like so sustaining in some ways that it really thrives in the darkness. Like we're saying, Brené Brown says it's like mushrooms thrive in like, you know, when there's no sunlight, shame really thrives. And so what we actually have to help clients know is that shame can go on forever internally unless we kind of bring it out and talk about it. And then maybe we can do the cresting fall thing. And I think that's a bit different than some other feelings.
Yeah, shame is, I think that's part of why it's called like a blocking emotion, is because it doesn't move.
No.
Like it's just,
it's there like it's an elephant on your chest.
Yep, yep. It's like this black hole of swirling. Yeah, I don't know how this fits into our conversation, but I'm also just thinking about like queer shame.
Mm.
I don't know how I want to put this in here, but maybe there's a parallel with like victims of sexual abuse or something where it's not yours. You know, it's like somebody comes in with shame and it's like, it's nothing you did.
Totally. Or who you are. It's, you know,
yeah. It's nothing you did. It's not about who you are. Like it's, it belongs to someone else and it's being put on you. And I think that can be a hard thing to undo when you have an entire culture saying you're bad.
Well, and that's
like
the thing.
If they're in a community that is just like, you're an irredeemable person because of your identity.
I think that's a great point. There can be people who have heard their whole life that they are bad because their abuser tells them that. But then there can be people who come in and they are being told by so many different messages, like in the media, in pop culture, on social media, that something about them is wrong and broken. This is where I'm like, the personal is political. Therapy is political. That an individual relationship with a therapist can do so much. But we also as mental health clinicians, I think, have to be pushing for society to change. Because this is like, this is the stuff where we can tell our clients till we're blue in the face that we love them and who they are is not broken. But if they leave the room and they hear that, it's also about how to help them like shield from it. That's hard. Yeah.
I have one more piece that I want to bring up, but
we
can totally edit this out if this doesn't fit.
Oh, I'm excited.
I think sometimes another piece that I saw on a therapist Facebook group recently that was very, very controversial. And I still don't know how I feel or what I would, but white shame, like white people shame, the shame of white privilege. And how do you move with that? I think people were talking about, oh, I'm working with this teenager who feels so much shame.
Interesting.
And they were all of these mostly white therapists being like, you know, that is not helpful. And we need to do, you know, because some people are saying, I think that we should unpack that and be like, how are you moving through that? How are you living aligned with your values? And other people being like, work with the shame as valid. I don't know. What do you think about, you know what I'm saying? Like,
sure. Well, I think this is where shame is not an adaptive. I don't want to say it like that.
Shame is not a motivator.
Shame is not a motivator. Thank you. Shame burns hot and fast. So shame makes us feel so like, I need to change everything about myself for very short spurts of time, but it's unsustainable. Where guilt is actually very helpful, because guilt makes us go like, oh, I've made a mistake. I've erred. I would like to rectify, apologize, and learn, and therefore not do that thing again. I loved when he said this earlier, shift from shame into guilt, because guilt is like movement. It's still a really shitty feeling. I'm not like, guilt, oh my God, it's amazing. But it usually feels less intense than shame, and it's usually easier to bear than shame. And it's much more like useful, concrete. We can do something. So I do think that there is, how do we help people to not sit in? I mean, we should not feel shame for how we were born. And it's important that we understand privilege, that we understand systems, where we exist in the world and how we exist, and how we want to make the world a better place. Shame is like a lead balloon. Like, it's not getting your parachute off the ground.
Yeah. Not only is it like that, you said hot and fast, it also is sometimes the opposite. Like, people can either be overwhelmed on that side of the window of tolerance, or
totally.
It's like they just dissociate and shut down. So that also doesn't get people to do anything. So in terms of working with that, I just think about like young people who feel, who come to therapy to talk about how they're white and how they feel shame. Yeah, I would probably have a conversation about values. Same. And what do you want to do with that? Like, yeah, this self-flagellation is doing nothing not for Black and Brown Indigenous people.
And for yourself, right? You know, it's not, no. Rarely is self-flagellation like helpful in motivation or getting anything done.
I'm listening to this book. Hmm. Not really. My partner's listening to this book. I was in the car also listening to the book. But where they were talking about the plague and how self-flagellation, people would whip themselves in the back like Jesus Christ did on the cross, or to be hurt the way that Jesus was, mm-hmm, in the hopes that it would protect them from the plague. And so it just makes me think about how sometimes people will beat up on themselves in shame to actually avoid looking at what they've done.
Ah, that like lifelong penance. I have to, for the rest of my life, feel bad and hate myself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's how I will make up for
something
being
I did.
Me. Not even something. Yeah. It's just sometimes just being me.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, and I think that's, as therapists, can be very delicate to sit with. Mm-hmm. And also really hard to see, because usually 99.9% of the time, I really like who my clients are.
Yeah.
And so when I hear them disparage themselves, when I hear them hold themselves accountable for stuff that is not theirs or is normal, like children's stuff especially, I'm just like, oh no, I wish you could see yourself through my eyes.
Yeah. To emphasize a point that came up earlier, what I'm taking away is just that feeling of, we can move it towards a type of emotion that does have movement, whether it's like you said, anger that's underneath, or even guilt, where amends need to be made. And then in that all encompassing shame that comes with like childhood trauma, that can be moved too.
I agree.
Like, it's slow moving, mm-hmm, and we must, as therapists, know that to be true. And I think as you have experience and you see, how can this person possibly move through this, because it's so all encompassing, you will see people work in therapy and it opens like a flower. Like, it's so, it takes time and a lot of back and forth, and it comes up again, but it really does change.
Mm-hmm. And it makes me think about our episode all about keeping hope alive. Like, this is where we hold the hope when our clients, mm-hmm, cannot see beyond how they currently feel, but we can, in not a flippant way, and not a like, nah, just wait, it'll be fine, but more in a like, I know the work can be effective, mm-hmm, and I trust, mm-hmm, and believe that there will come a time when you like yourself 1% better and, mm-hmm, more than you do right now, right?
Yep.
I like to think about the work in millimeters.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to say to close?
I hoped we would get to talking about shame for new therapists, but it maybe is a Patreon episode or a full separate episode, because it's here at Parallel.
I forgot about that.
It's okay. I loved this conversation. I guess I'm wondering how it is for our listeners when shame comes up with their clients, what comes up for them, what they do, and if they have any questions for us, any other points that we didn't get to that they'd want to hear about.
If you have any thoughts, you can email us at connect@edgeofthecouch.com. You can follow us on Instagram at edgeofthecouchpod. You can also join our Patreon, patreon.com/edgeofthecouch, where we do, what do we do?
Other topics.
We do other topics. Of ourselves. Yeah, we share more about ourselves. True.
We share bigger opinions, I think, or more like, here's our opinion type energy.
It feels a little bit messier. So if you like it to be a little bit messier, you can head on to Patreon at patreon.com/edgeofthecouch.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Hey, this is Shelby from the Jane team. Jane is an all-in-one practice management software designed to save you time, with features like user-friendly online booking, efficient medical charting, and an integrated payment solution. Here at Jane, we know your treatment time is valuable, and you'd much rather be helping your patients and clients than filling out paperwork or chasing payment information. Jane's online intake forms help you maximize your treatment time by collecting all of the right information before your patient even walks through the door. Whether you need to collect a credit card on file, insurance billing details, or sign consent, you can customize your forms to fit your practice needs. And Jane is PIPEDA compliant, so you can feel confident knowing that your patient's data is stored securely. With patient details saved directly to their profile and questionnaires to their chart, you can say goodbye to your bulky filing cabinet for good. Learn more by heading to jane.app/guide.
Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at connect@edgeofthecouch.com to tell us what you think, ask a question, or let us know what type of episode you'd love to hear. You can even send us a voice note for us to play in a future episode.
You can support us by giving us a review on Apple Podcasts, sharing the show with a friend, or supporting us on Patreon.
Join us next time at the Edge of the Couch.